You are listening to Within Tolerance, a podcast for machinists by a machinist. I'm your host, Dylan Jackson of Protean Machining. And this week, I am very happy to welcome back Ethan Patain. Welcome, Ethan.
Hey, thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for coming back on. I know you had reached out because you were doing a lot of mentorship and training and stuff, and that has been kind of a big theme as of late on the podcast. And so I'm really looking forward to hearing your insights and what's been going on. So for anybody who hasn't heard Ethan's backstory, head on back to episode 153. He kind of dives into how he got into manufacturing and how he got to where he is now. But let's get an update. What have you been doing since the last time we've talked?
Lots of stuff has changed and some stuff has not changed at all. Last we talked, I was like, I think 3/4 of the way through my Moog co-op. And I had just machined the Stormtrooper and the Impeller, I believe. So I finished up that co-op and then went back to school in the fall. I interviewed with a few other companies. Arch Quakertown, where Chief Bub works. Renscott, Addison Precision, which is a local shop. Eventually ended up going back to Moog because it's close and I loved how the people treated me. And it was an awesome job. I got to see my friends every weekend. So that was good to like be a person and have mental health.
For sure.
So
actually, there was one thing I wanted to ask you because of Ledgerd being on. How does it feel going back and forth between school and then these internships? Like, I would imagine for me, especially like as someone who doesn't really appreciate being in a classroom all that much, you would get this kind of feeling of freedom of like, oh, I've got a real job and I'm a real adult person. And why would I go back? So how do you balance that?
That is a very good question. And sometimes I don't know. I wouldn't say there is no balance, but it's very difficult because you go out and like you just said, you are very much a real person and you go home and you don't have 6 hours of homework to do. And it's like, well, geez, what do I do with my time now? And so you get very accustomed to having lots of free time and being able to go for a bike ride whenever you want. And then you come back and you just get slammed. So I guess the answer is you don't always deal with it. You just kind of go with the flow and do the best that you can.
So do you kind of get, I guess, like the Monday scaries, but like the semester scaries as you're winding down an internship?
Yeah, definitely. I'm very excited to go to an internship or a co-op. Like, I'm very excited right now to go to a full-time job, but I was not very excited to come back. I definitely would say the Sunday scaries, yeah.
All right. So then was this your last semester then?
I'm currently wrapping up my second to last semester. Yep. Yeah. So I think last time I was on, I was around like 1500 parts, closing in on $3,000 now. So I passed my 2K goal. So that's good. My formula team competed in Michigan this past summer. We placed 4th out of 72 teams. So we're super excited about that. We are currently running a crowdfunding campaign. So if anybody's interested in supporting, we're switching to hub motors this coming year. So we're looking for resources and looking for people to help. So anyway, we'd love some support.
I'll link that in the show notes for sure.
Okay. Yeah. I appreciate it. In terms of cool new projects, I made some other impellers, the triple splitter impellers, and the mini F30, the mini formula car. That was definitely a cool one. I have that right here, actually sitting on my desk. Just chilling.
Oh, that's killer.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to be very careful about who I show it to because people will like grab it out of my hands and not be very careful with it. Yeah.
I understand why it's on your desk at home then, for sure.
Yeah. It could not be at my desk in the shop. I'm looking for full-time jobs. Talking to Renscott. I'm going to work for them for a few weeks in the winter. Talking to Easton. I'm going to go visit him shortly. That's sort of it for new stuff. Let's see. I think that
let's get into, what you reached out about. So how has it been? I assume the reason you've been doing more mentoring and stuff is that you're kind of preparing for you leaving. And as someone who in the past has dedicated 60 hours a week to this team, how has it been to kind of pass the reins and teach people?
It's been extremely frustrating, extremely rewarding, and like everything from A to Z, really. I have some rules for myself that I've put together from talking to a lot of people who are much more experienced mentors of mine. There's seven things. I wrote them down. I have them here. There's seven things that I tell myself to forget. Forget time. Mentoring is slow, extremely slow. Forget your standards and expectations. Everyone starts somewhere, and expecting them to live up to what you've done is a one-way ticket to disappointment for all parties. Forget first impressions. Patience is key, and almost all students have potential. Forget your age, skills, and talents. You are the servant now, and it's your job to be a servant leader. Forget your ego. It's about growing the student, not how much you've grown. Mentoring is a personal race to see how much you can teach. Forget what you think you know and see. You are having an impact even if it doesn't show. Forget those with no desire to learn. You can't help someone who doesn't want to be helped. And so those
kind of, I love that.
Those guiding morals have really helped me out. And pretty much everything falls under those, that seven-piece umbrella. And I have to constantly remind myself of those things, especially when you're heated and someone says something you don't like and you're like, oh, you got to remind yourself that it probably doesn't matter.
For sure. How do you go about finding projects for people you're mentoring? Because, you know, especially looking at it as a business owner, that's one thing that scares me the most about bringing people on to train is, you know, I work in a very fast-paced job. Like, we have orders that ship in a matter of hours, not days or weeks sometimes. So how do you go about finding the right teachable moments, I guess?
Yeah. So in previous years, or I guess I should say, because we've had multiple cars that have taken multiple years to build, which is not ideal, there have been quick years and there have been slow years. In the quick years, like this one, we have a form where designers submit parts to, and I just assign people to a part, and I say, figure it out. If you have questions, come ask me. So that's the easy part. In the slow years, it's obviously much more difficult. During those slow years, I've tried to encourage people to take a walk around the shop and find something that they don't like and fix it. You don't even have to tell me what it is. Just fix it. You don't like how the broom closet is organized, like three Prinsum organizers, or you don't like our grinding vise because that's clunky to use. Go 3D print some organizers and buy some parallels for it. Stuff like that. So it's been tough on those off years, but this year it's been quite easy.
What about like specific machining projects? How do you go about assigning a somewhat green person to those and making sure that they succeed?
So this year I have been mentoring more beginners than any year before. For them, well, I'll kind of go person by person. I've got one buddy named Joe, and the way I mentor Joe is I give him a project, and initially he was very intimidated by these projects because I gave him big projects. And so he would come and ask me questions quite frequently. And I would always give him the answers. And then I realized I got to stop because I'm not going to be here next year to give you the answers. And so I started saying, well, I don't know, Joe, how would you do it? And then I noticed like significant personal growth on his behalf when I started asking him the questions back to him rather than just answering his questions. And now he'd be like, you know what? I know, like, let me cook. I'm going to go figure it out. So that's how I approach sort of the greener members. Some people need their hand held more. Some people really just want to be told what to do and just want to hear it as it is. So I think that kind of answers that question.
How do you differentiate those kind of people? Because I would find people who want to be led like that or want to be handheld frustrating, you know, coming from a background of not being that kind of person. So, you know, going into like leaving the ego out of this, how do you go about dealing with people with personalities different from your own?
Yeah, that is very difficult, as is every part of mentorship. Dealing with personalities, I try to take it out of the picture completely. In terms of determining who needs what kind of help, to a degree, I have to rely on the student to tell me what they need, because I'm not a mind reader and neither are you. And so if you don't tell me what you need, I'm never going to know. I have learned through failure who enjoys and needs different kinds of mentorship. I've got a buddy, Ethan, who initially needed a lot of assistance. I'd say he needed positive feedback. He needed to know that his ideas were good and that they weren't going to fail. And so he would bring me this idea and he'd say, I've got this idea, but I'm not sure it's going to work. And I would say, try it. It's probably going to work. If it doesn't work, you're going to figure it out. And I've got other buddies who bring me ideas that won't work, but I can't say they won't work because that hurts their feelings and I have to walk them through why they won't work. And so you sort of start off with a blanket approach and then through failure, you determine what works and what doesn't. And I'm sure there are better ways of approaching it, but that's sort of how I approached it when I was green to mentorship.
Okay. Are there specific anecdotes that you can mentally link to each one of your seven steps that you can remember over the last year or two? Or any ones that stand out, you know, specific of the seven that you have good anecdotes for?
I think the ego thing is the biggest part because people in at our age have a very tough time determining when you're trying to help versus when you're trying to brag, especially in a competitive team like this, where it's just the nature of the team is that we all want to grow and sure, we all want to succeed, but really like everybody is in it at the end of the day for like personal gains. And so it has been brought to my attention before that people think I'm bragging or they think I'm arrogant. And so by reiterating that we leave the egos at the door, I think that has really helped everybody understand where I'm coming from. And I think I've really turned that reputation around among certain people.
That's good. I think that that's a tough line to straddle. Like I know I think I've said it before on the podcast that like, I think any machinist that's been in this long enough kind of has to have a fair bit of an ego because you are running machines that, you know, most of us can't afford through of an entire year's paycheck or something like that. Like this is not a cheap vocation to fail. Like, you know, small mistakes still might be a $10,000 mistake. So you kind of have to have that ego of like, well, I'm the best and whatever I think is going to be right and I'm going to make it right. And yeah, so I can definitely see that as being a big hurdle for anybody trying to do mentorship.
Yeah, it's very difficult because I try to portray this to try to convey it to my designer counterparts. You guys have a control Z button. I do not have an undo crash or an undo break end mill button or, you know, an undo spend 6 hours programming this because now it's not going to work button. It's very difficult to get that across to people. And fortunately, I think people are now starting to understand that. When I first joined the team, CNC group was kind of treated as just like the bitch group. And you give them a step file and a print and they better make the part. But now it's very much fostered an environment of communication to the point where I don't even need to remind people anymore because people will say, they'll be designing a part and they'll say, well, this looks tricky. I better go ask Ethan. And then I'll be like, yeah, you're right. That's tricky. Good for you for noticing. Let's fix it. And so that's something that I've been very proud of, that change that I've tried to help foster.
Yeah, that actually brings up one of the listener questions. Drive Manufacturing asks, do you find yourself helping engineering students understand manufacturing limitations because of your involvement in FSAE? So what does that collaboration look like? I think that that kind of harkens back to the book club book, Extreme Ownership and Leading Up the Chain. And like, maybe they're not your superiors, but like, you know, the engineering shit does roll downhill from them. So how do you deal with that? What does that collaboration look like and how did you foster that?
So I actually took notes of some of these questions before and kind of jotted down some answers. And so I was sort of halfway answering that just before. It has been extremely rewarding to work with them and see them develop their skills. But at the same time, sometimes you do need to lay down the law and be like, listen, I know you don't understand, but for now, I'm just going to just need you to trust me. Like, I need you to make this change so that it's easier for me to make this part. To answer the question directly, yes, I definitely have enjoyed and had a large part in teaching the people on the team a lot about, you know, design for manufacturing and things of that nature. I've enjoyed teaching people, not just because I like teaching, but because of what I get out of it. One of my buddies, Garrett, is extremely curious about everything in life. Sometimes I call him Curious George. He is constantly asking these really awesome questions about things that I don't even think about anymore because they're just so mundane. And his curiosity has really inspired me to be more curious. And so that's been really awesome to mentor people like that, because their personalities wear off on me and I benefit from that as well.
Yeah, that's killer. So let's say a new person comes into the group. How do you start someone off? Like, do you have a track that you follow, like certain projects or certain resources that you turn them to? Day one, what do they get? And then how do they progress through your mentorship?
So we face this problem pretty much every year, multiple times every year throughout the year as well. When someone comes in completely green, they've never turned a hand wheel. We have a series of practice parts that they make manually. We've got a couple mill parts, just literally, as Pat says, blocks with holes. We have some dice and then a couple lathe practice parts and then some parts that you sort of practice both of those processes together. Some people come in and say, listen, I've done this all before. Can I start doing more advanced stuff? Then we tend to give those people actual parts that go on the car. We don't give them, you know, like a suspension upright or some like ridiculously tight tolerance spacer or something like that. But we'll give them some basic brackets that mount on the car for mounting suspension and things like that. So that's sort of how we deal with people who are very green, people who are right in the middle, people who come in with a lot of experience. This year, we've got a guy named Leif. He is awesome. He's like, he's mini me. I really am looking forward to seeing where he grows. He came in and was like, listen, I've done this all before. I know what I'm doing. Can you trust me and let me do things? And we just sort of let him cook, like I was saying earlier. And he really impressed us. He's been doing awesome stuff. He works on lots of personal projects. He helps out. He helps mentor other new members on the team. And so when we've got 50 people in the shop and there's like 9 people for every elected member, it's nice to have someone that we can trust and say, Leif, can you just go teach these people? So that kind of answered that question for all 3 levels.
Awesome. So speaking of a mini you, have you chosen your successor and how does that process go? Like, what additional training are you giving someone to step into your shoes?
So I don't really choose anybody to be the successor, but I am very proud to know that there are so many people following in my footsteps. I don't want people to do exactly what I did because that's unreasonable, but we've got 4, 5, maybe 6 people following in my footsteps, whereas when I joined, there was nobody. And so the future for the group is looking very strong. As far as mentoring those people, I think sort of just goes back to what I've been saying all along, how we dish out these projects and how we assess everybody's skills as they join the team.
But in terms of, you know, teaching them how to schedule and things like that, you know, that's, it sounds like a big part of being the CNC lead is, you know, knowing the right people for the right job and timelines and keeping that all on a, you know, I don't know if it's a board or a spreadsheet or in your head or whatever. That's its own training in and of itself.
Yeah. So a lot of that training just comes by watching. And so people have seen over the years how I've organized things. As I was mentioning earlier, we have that spreadsheet that's linked to a Google form and designers fill those out and we have a priority list and we can just sort it by priority and say, it's Wednesday night. We need these parts in 3 days. Who's doing them? Hayden, you're doing them. And so he works on those. Someone less experienced works on a part with, you know, less priority. And so they kind of just learn by seeing how I've done it. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, for sure. How does the priority list get established? Who decides what is priority? That's always interesting to me on itch ops.
Yeah. So it's tough because everybody thinks, you know, their parts are 10, number 10. We needed them yesterday. We needed them last week. The bottleneck group changes from week to week and day to day. And so that priority list changes. But at the time that the designer submits the manufacturing form, they just have to estimate how quickly they need their parts. And we don't really have a great way to improve that system because, as I'm sure Ledyard knows, things change so quickly on these project teams and shit just hits the fan. You know, one day chassis is the problem, the next day powertrain is the problem, the next day manufacturing has a broken machine and we can't make your parts. So it changes and there isn't really a great way to differentiate the different priority levels.
That's fair. Your mom actually asked the question, what mistake has taught you the most? And so I want to kind of piggyback off that. And then what mistake has someone you've been mentoring also taught you the most?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing in mentorship is just being open with your people and honest when you make a mistake, because everybody knows when you make a mistake. And the only thing you can do to make it worse is say that you didn't make the mistake and try and cover it up. A couple years ago, I screwed up a pretty major relationship in my life, and it taught me a lot about being honest and open and how important communication is. So I would say when you make a mistake, own up to it. As far as the biggest mistake that I've seen someone make, we have never had a crash, at least in my 5 years. We have broken tools, just like everybody does. I want to say the worst thing that's happened is like you load a part wrong and the end mill breaks. We've really had a clean track record. The most common thing is we don't have a tool setter because we're running a ProtoTrack mill, and the thing is like, it's a code runner. It runs like G1, G2, G3. And if you ask more of it, it's not going to do much. So we set tool lengths manually. The biggest mistake people make is they jog the end mill down while there's a dowel pin under it, and they chip the end mill. And it's like, oof, it's not the end of the world. It's tough. It's annoying, but you know, they only make the mistake once.
For sure. What about in your internships? Have you made any mistakes that have taught you a really valuable lesson?
I certainly have made my fair share of mistakes. A lot of the mistakes that would have been bad on the machine get caught by a Veracut or NX, or they get caught by the simulations on the machine. One really bad crash that I did see happen that I got to teach people from was on the Okumas, at least on the MU5000s at Moog. They, from the factory, were configured to only turn the rotary axes clockwise. And so it doesn't matter if you command, you know, like C1 to like C359, it's not going to go 2 degrees. It's going to go 300 and some odd degrees. And so someone had a long tool holder with a long end mill buried way down inside this manifold, and they were trying to do some live five work. And this thing just tied the tool holder in a knot. It totally went all the way around, ripped the tool holder out of the spindle. Unfortunately, they're beefy enough machines that it ended up not really being a problem. But that was a big mistake that I did actually know of, but the person running the machine did not know. And so I got to make everybody else aware. Yeah.
How does that work then? Can you not do live five down in a pocket then? Like, you know, if I was doing like a parallel toolpath in a pocket and it's going back and forth and trying to keep off the center of the ball, can you just not do that?
No, you can. There's just parameter way down in the settings that you got to flip. There's also an M code that you can do it like block by block. But otherwise, yeah. Yep.
Did you find out the reason that they have that enabled?
I think it may have been a Moog request because they do so little live five and they just want all the machines to be the same. But at the same time, I don't know why you wouldn't want it to just take the shortest rotary path at all times. I'm not sure. I never really got an answer to that.
Okay. Yeah. That sounds like one of those things that there was a terrible crash at some point way in the distant past and they decided, well, this is just how it's going to be.
Yeah.
I both love to hear stories like that just because I'm curious, and also usually I hate to hear it because it's such a terrible story.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Let's talk about kind of the industry at large. So Steel Phil, and I think there was one more, Mike Lynch, were asking, you know, you've seen some outstanding shops and also the waste and grime within each of them. Phil was eager to know where you're going to go and what your outlook is on participating in manufacturing. And then Mike also wanted to know what has surprised you along the way in the industry, maybe some blatant room for improvement.
Yeah. I'll answer. Let's see the first one first. First I'll admit I have seen a very small percentage of the industry, and I'll be the first person to say that. Like, really my specialty is five axis milling and stuff, you know, more basic than that. I don't do a whole lot of turning and things of that nature. To be honest, given the state of manufacturing education in formal educations, if you only look at that, it looks pretty bleak, because we have people who show up for the freshman sort of like engineering manufacturing class and they learn how to turn a mill on and turn some hand wheels, and then they completely forget it. And then they show up 4 years later in the shop for their senior design project, and they got to like refigure out which way to turn the screwdriver. And so if you just look at education, manufacturing in formal education settings, it does not look optimistic. But when you look around on the Instagram community and the Instant Machinist Discord and things like that, it looks very hopeful because we've got so many young, educated machinists who are constantly, you know, pushing the cutting edge of this industry, coming up with awesome ideas and trying innovative things. In terms of Mike's question, the most surprising thing about the industry, something that you always say is, if you're just not an asshole, it's crazy how far you get. I was also very surprised by how willing people are to trust you if you look like you know what you're doing. I try to be very confident in my interactions, and sometimes that comes off as overbearing or arrogant. But if you just show people that you know what they're doing, that you know what you're doing, or even if you don't and you just pretend like you do and you know that you'll figure it out, people will trust you. There was no reason for anybody to trust me without showing them that I've been formally trained on how to run these machines, but they just trusted me and I made it happen. So I would say, yeah, don't be a prick. And if you're confident, people will give you opportunities.
Yeah, I'll even tack on, like, even confidently saying, well, I'm not sure about this, but these are the reasons why I believe this, is often enough for people to believe you and just say, well, you know, you're at 90%. All of us are at 50%. You know, go on.
Yep.
So that's very interesting.
Yeah.
As someone who's younger and in manufacturing, do you have any ideas on how we could attract more people to this and make it, you know, make manufacturing cool or, yeah, you know, worth doing, I guess?
Yeah, I would certainly encourage everybody to ask the questions that they want to ask and don't hold anything back. And if you're looking for a mentor, or even if you're not, and you just don't even know that a mentor would be the right thing for you, you should just go out and ask people questions. Reach out to a local shop, ask if you can have a tour, because it's been shoved down the throats of people in formal education for so many years that these trades are dirty and, you know, you're too good for them. When in reality, there are a lot of people who are going into engineering and they very much could have played an important role in manufacturing, or people who go into finance who, you know, hate their job. Maybe they would love welding or being a pipe fitter, you know? So it kind of has to start at a systemic level, because we're never going to fully solve the problem until the solutions is seeping from the veins of, you know, seeping from the roots.
But, right. Yeah. Well, what about as like shop owners or people in the business? What can we do to attract more young people to the trade?
The organizations like First Robotics and VEX, I think, are a great place to start. Find a local team, because there's, I think we're closing in on 9,000 First Robotics teams now in the world, which means there's probably one within 15 miles of your shop. So reach out to a robotics team or a high school team and ask if you can mentor, or ask if they want to take a tour, or ask if you can take a tour of their shop space and go in and share the things that you have to say with them, because it's such a large world, but nobody knows anything about anyone, and you have no idea what people are doing if you don't reach out and ask.
Yeah, I love that. So many people who have been on this show started in First Robotics or things like that. So certainly seems like a great place of outreach.
Yep, for sure.
Let's see. We got a few questions about long-term goals. So Ledgered, and I think there was one more, asked, what are your long-term manufacturing and career goals? Where do you see yourself in 5, 10, 25 years?
I definitely want to continue working in modern workspaces. I'm not really interested in massive companies where change takes a million years to implement. So medium to small size modern companies. In 5 years, I would say maybe 50 to 75% of the way to owning my own shop is where I'd like to be. In 10 years, I would very much like to be working full-time for myself. And in 25, God help me if I'm not independently running a shop and, you know, doing things and helping others.
Okay. Yeah. Well, actually, it was Tux Garage. So he asked, what is your next achievement goal? How are you planning on outdoing yourself next? And when are you opening your own shop?
When am I opening my own shop? Well, I just answered that. Hopefully, like 5 or 10 years. I'm hoping it's sooner than that. When am I going to outdo myself? This is a tough one for me to talk or think about, because I'm very much a person who thinks that there's always more to learn. But at a certain point, once you get off the steep portion of the learning curve in a certain setting, you feel like you're plateauing, and it's a very scary feeling. And I'm nearing that point at the shop, with the shop on campus, because I've made so many different parts and I've learned so much. And that's not to say that there isn't infinitely more to learn, but I feel like I'm squeezing the last few drops of juice out of the shop. And so I'm very much looking forward to going out into the industry and meeting new people and running different machines and working on cool new projects. Since my team has switched to Hub Motors, we are designing this new funky component that combines the functionality of a motor cooling jacket, a suspension upright, and a planetary gearbox to gear down the motor. So that'll be a very interesting part that will require some serious material removal, which I'll probably do this winter at Renscott.
Ooh, awesome. That sounds like a ton of fun. So yeah, I guess what would your, do you have a next project on the horizon? Because, you know, if you look at your Instagram and, you know, a lot of, I would expect a lot of your interactions from the community at large are these, you know, capstone projects that you've kind of done just for the fun of it, like your impellers or your stormtrooper helmet, or now your model car. Do you have another one that you've been starting to think of?
I have some smaller ones that don't involve five axis mills that I no longer have access to. I have a model of the Himalayan terrain that I'm going to machine maybe like 8 or 10 inch diameter puck. I think, Juan did that. He made a video on his Instagram a long time ago about that. Other projects. The other day I designed a variable swash plate hydraulic pump for fun, and I might machine that. Other than that, at the moment, not really. Just that hub motor gearbox. That'll be an interesting one.
Awesome. Do you typically, you know, make those projects around a certain skill you're looking to learn?
Historically, not really. I've sort of designed them around the circumstances that I'm in. I have a five axis. What can I do with it? I have this machine shop at school. What can I do with it? Usually it's just someone proposes a cool idea and I'm like, I don't think I could do that. Actually, maybe I could do that. I'm going to do that. And then I do it.
Okay. Speaking of learning, Easton at Moria asked, what are some of the skills you want to learn moving forward that you haven't had the opportunity to learn yet? And he says it applies to both of us.
Do you want to answer first?
Or do you need a moment? I really want to get like some hands-on with an EDM. I had like one class in school, and for like 90% of the semester, the EDM was down and it really sucked. Like, we did a little bit of Esprit programming and he had us read the manual for the machine, but like, I cut these tiny little V blocks. I think I have two of them. And then that was it. And it's like, I don't remember anything about it. They seem like such cool machines. I would love some more time on like a real modern one with, you know, UV axes and really cut some weird tapers and stuff like that.
Yeah. EDM is a pretty unbelievable field of manufacturing. I was very lucky to do quite a bit of that during my first co-op at Moog. It was funny listening to Alex talk about it on the, I guess, second to last episode, learning about his learning experiences. It was funny because I remember going through the same things and being like, you can just reverse the polarity and just burn off part of the electrode. That was very cool. For me, some things that I want to keep learning, I learned how to weld, how to TIG weld and MIG weld maybe like a year and a half ago. I'm not horrible, but I'm not great. So I enjoy learning that. It's fun to be on the very steep part of the learning curve again. Let's see. I don't do a ton of lathe work. I do enough where, you know, they say I'm dangerous, but I'm not useful. So I do a decent bit of lathe work, but I'd love to do more. Mil-turn stuff is always something that's interested me, but I haven't done a ton of. I think those are my three answers.
Okay. Yeah, I dig that. Mil-turns would be cool too. Like, I'd love some time on a B-axis mil-turn. I think that'd be really excellent.
Yeah.
Let's see. Joe Minetti asked, what's your number one piece of advice for people new to CNC?
So Joe is my good friend. We sit next to each other in the shop, and he's the youngest new member of the manufacturing group. I struggled for a long time with teaching people how to approach programming a part because it's so unbelievably overwhelming when all you know is turning hand wheels and making square things. But what I have determined, a good way that I've determined to approach it is think of it like cooking, where you have a finite list of fairly simple processes, and you can break it down as far as you want. You can break it down, you know, you can do milling and turning, and then you can do different types of tool paths, different work holding, things like that. And when you break it down into these very small finite steps, it becomes very easy to sketch out a plan for how you're going to approach a part. And by the time you spent 10 or 15 minutes just breaking this part down, you realize it's really not that intimidating anymore. So I would say, break things down step by step and continue breaking them down until you can't possibly break it down anymore. And then you've got a list of steps to follow, and it's not going to be as overwhelming as it once was.
Are you guys mostly a Mastercam shop at school?
We were Mastercam for 25 years, and then that license was managed by the other half of our shop, and it was just such a pain to keep it up that we switched to Fusion my second year. And that's worked out great for us because, as you know, the cloud libraries, cloud everything.
Yeah, that's why I asked this, is how do you deal, what is your strategy for introducing, you know, the tool libraries? Do you have any template files that you introduce people to so that they can kind of glean, you know, quote unquote, the right way to do things? And like you can give them, you know, at least a head start on programming parts. How do you handle that?
Yeah, so for the very beginning, you kind of just throw someone into the software and say, mess around with this for a couple hours, and then they'll figure out the ins and outs. As far as templates are something that I have spent a huge amount of time implementing because it speeds things up so much. When we have to make one or two of a part and then we never have to think about it again, it doesn't make sense to spend, you know, 8 hours picking like contours and heights and planes. And so templates are a huge thing that I've implemented. Last summer, I went through all 1,600 of our end mills and measured and labeled every single one with a label maker, and created this huge Excel spreadsheet with all the flute lengths, all the relief length, corner radii, flutes, coating, manufacturer, whatever. And then you actually can format that in such a way where you can copy it directly into a Fusion tool library, and then it copies them all in automatically. And so now when you need a tool, prior to my implementation of that, you'd have to go over to the cabinet, find the tool you want, model it. Now you just filter by the parameters and you've got 1,600 end mills at your fingertips. You know exactly which one it is. You find the number, you go over to the binder. The binder tells you which drawer it's in. You just pull the drawer out and pull the end mill out. That's been super helpful. Standard tool library, as in standard tools that stay in our machine. We've got 9 tools and we have a library with all those. When we take tools out of the machine, but we're not going to take them apart, we move them into a different cloud library. We call that the cabinet library. Those are just in our cabinet. So we do have a fairly, not strict, but formatted plan for getting people up to speed on how we do things. There's never really a right or a wrong way, but there are ways that don't make sense and make sense for everybody to be doing the same thing. And so we try to implement that.
So you reminded me tangentially about your last episode. What's the status of the Akuma and the water jet?
Oh boy. Well, I have since decided that I'm not going to give anyone in that half of the shop a second of my mental time, which has been really great for my mental health. Just like not caring about them anymore. They still come over and ask me questions all the time, and I have to be happy to help them because that's how you foster good relationships. The mill is running, needed some major replacement parts in the spindle. The water jet, I believe, is running now, but perhaps is still a little fickle. That's kind of the updates on it. Actually, what is very funny, there's an Akuma mill and an Akuma lathe, and just above the lathe is a wastewater pipe coming from a bathroom directly above it. And now 3 times this year, the thing has busted and rained piss water down on top of the lathe.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's so terrible.
Yeah. I'm told that the first time it got into the coolant tank and then they had to swap it, but I'm not entirely sure. I don't work there or really interact with them a whole lot anymore.
Okay. Oh, that's gross. Yeah. Let's see. Carolina CNC man asked, he says he's done a lot of woodworking in the past and finds it very frustrating as opposed to metalworking. Which do you prefer and why? And have you been doing any woodworking?
I have not been doing any woodworking because since my parents moved to Maine, I just have had no like significant portions of time to go spend up there. During winter and summer breaks, I go up there and set my shop up, but it's just so much effort to set it up and I have so little time to use it that I haven't really done any woodworking. I think there is very much a place for both in my life. Machining is extremely demanding and it's a very violent process often with chips flying everywhere and coolant lining the walls of the enclosure. There is definitely some beauty to the whole process, but woodworking is a much more serene thing. You don't really go home at the end of a long day and like blast some loud music and let a sheer hog rip for 4 hours. You go home and you hand cut some dovetails because it's a quiet and fun activity. So there's definitely very much a place for both in my life. I could see myself owning a shop in the future. And when that is settled as a shop ever can be, having a wood shop at home, probably a small one, and just making random things here and there.
Awesome. Carson Tosta asked, what is your dream CNC project, money no object?
Carson actually just approached me the other day and asked if I could help him build a header for his bike that he found on Facebook Marketplace for $200. That actually would be a really cool project, but I'm not sure how possible it is with our equipment. Before I started working on the Stormtrooper project, I had a life-size model of Grogu. Everyone calls him Baby Yoda, but his name is Grogu. And I was going to machine that as my final project instead of the Stormtrooper, but it was an STL. And when I converted it to a solid model, my computer crashed multiple times because it was like 1.5 million elements. I forget who was on the podcast a while ago, but it was someone from Hermla, and they talked about converting an STL to a solid model and putting an organic surface over it. I'm not sure who that was.
Oh, it was Kyle, I think, when they were doing the gingerbread house with like the front yard and stuff.
Yeah. They must have had the patience of a saint to do that because I spent multiple hours on it and it was just way too much.
So I wonder if something like Blender could take care of that and like simplify it a little bit.
I'm sure it probably could simplify it. I put it in there and spent a little time fiddling with it, but didn't have a whole lot of success. And Blender also does not put any solid file types, which is interesting.
Oh, yeah, that's a little frustrating.
Yeah.
I think your friend Garrett asked, what is it about making parts that you enjoy?
For me, I think the whole process is quite beautiful. There's not really a step that I don't like other than cleaning the coolant tank. That just sucks. I love taking a block of material and programming this part in whatever way I please and seeing it emerge and helping other people, you know, materialize their dreams, quite literally. Seeing this block of metal turn into this beautiful machine component is very nice. It infiltrates parts of my life that I wish it wouldn't infiltrate, because I'll wake up in the morning and I'll see like 759 or 601 or whatever, and I'll be like, oh, it's out of tolerance. It's not exactly 600. So that's something that I don't love.
It's funny you say that, because Brad and I have a constant joke. It'll be like, we'll see something like, you know, it'll be like a serial number or something, and it'll have like 393 at the beginning. I'm like, oh, 1 millimeter. Yeah. And like, we'll constantly catch ourselves doing that. And yeah, it's the same thing. It just like intrudes on everywhere else in your life.
It's so bad. I'll see license plates and I'll be like, I don't know, 5625. Hey, that's 9/16. And my friends will be like, you're autistic. And I'm like, no, I'm not. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but like, I just noticed these numbers.
I'm just a machinist.
it's not bad that I have a favorite fraction. Like, I'm allowed to do that.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Garrett also asked, if you could only use one machine tool to make parts for the rest of your life, what would it be and why?
I saw that question and man, you can't do that to me. I think my ideal machine tool would be probably a combination of multiple machines, maybe like the kinematics and the accuracy of a Curran, the layout of an Integrex so that you can machine such a variety of parts, maybe the rigidity of a Mori or a Hermla, and a Heidenheim control, I would say would be the ideal machine. I had a class several years ago. It was like intro to technology and society or something. And for our final project, it was pretty open-ended. And so I designed a machine that was a compilation of all sorts of different machines. I believe it was the enclosure of an Okuma, the spindle of a Kern. It had a Haas control. It had the Datron vacuum card table, the side mount tool changer, the door of the new like DNM Doosans. It was such an ugly atrocity, but it reminds me of this compilation of machines that I'm imagining.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you too, now that you're looking for a job after school, how do you go about evaluating employers? Because I think that that's an important thing. A lot of shop owners, or at least in my experience when I've gone out for jobs, I think do a really poor job of communicating both the ethos of the company, what they actually do, and how they go about doing it. So what are the steps and what are the things that you look for in a potential employer?
I'm still very much figuring that out. But the first thing, just like you've said so many times, is are they kind and do they respect me? If I have to right off the bat keep arguing for myself because they keep explaining things to me that I already know and things that are on my resume, that's a check engine light, I would say. I walked into a shop for an interview recently and they said, what are you looking for in terms of money? And I said, I'm looking for X, Y, and Z. And they said, in so many words, they said, that's insane. Nobody out of college should be making that much money. Like, you should go with whatever company offered you that. And I was like, I didn't say anything. I was like, okay, I understand. And I walked out thinking like, I probably could have saved you that much money in 6 months. So it's your loss. And I can't believe you just spoke to me like that. So that's a big red flag. Can't be going to shops like that.
I had an almost identical experience maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I went to an interview and he seemed to love me. And then we got to the end of it and I was like, I want this much an hour. That's what I was making at my last job. And he was like, whoa, that's way, you know, insane. And then so I was like, all right, well, thanks anyway, and left. And then he continued to call me. I think it was once every month for the next 6 months, trying to get me to come back and saying, no, I made a mistake. You're worth that. We want you. We really need you. And I was like, dude, no, I'm done. Like, yeah. I've already found a job. Thanks.
Yeah, that ship has sailed. Yep. I have a spreadsheet that I use for cataloging all the people that I've met, and not like sociopath, I counted that, but like cataloging all the shops that I've toured and things that I like, things I don't like, salary, location, things like that. And so that helps break down the materialistic aspects of it. But at the end of the day, it comes down to a more like emotional decision. Where do I want to spend my time? Who do I enjoy being around? And that matters a lot more to me than whether or not they've got a G350, you know,
or two. Well, what are the things that you've seen in shops that you do like that, like attract you as a potential employee?
Immediately when you walk into a shop, you can tell if it's clean. You can tell if it, you know, smells terrible. You can tell if employees are happy to be there. That's one that you can immediately tell. When you're getting walked around, if it's a small enough company, you're probably getting walked around by the owner. So if people are not like cowering in fear as the owner walks around, that's a green flag. If machines are running, you know, you can't always have every machine running, but if every machine is idle for your entire tour there, that's something to think about. Organization, like I just said, are things clean? How is their inspection? Is there a CMM room, just some like tiny room that they built with some 2x4s and put drywall on? Or is it thermally controlled? And, you know, are there sticky mats on the floor to prevent you from bringing FOD into the room and things like that? Attention to detail is a big thing.
Yeah, I like that for sure. It is, it's very interesting. You know, you were talking about the owner walking around. That was the one thing that when I went to Hermla in Germany, like shocked me, is Gunther was doing our tour for my group. And not a single person, you know, freaked out with us walking by. And like most of them were like joking with him. And like even in the ones on break, you know, it's so rare to see that in the US, I think, where, you know, usually everybody, even if they're on break or they're on lunch, you know, either cowers and tries to get out of eye line or jumps to it and like pretends that they were working the whole time. And there was not a single person that did that. And it was very refreshing to see.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't see that in the typical representation of a machine shop that is pushed in modern education. You think of it as, or you don't think of it, but you see it represented as one big guy at the top, and it's usually some like overweight white guy, and everybody else is afraid of him. And that's very much not the case in many modern shops these days.
Right. Well, yeah, you mentioned earlier the servant leader, and like that's kind of what, at least for me, when I was working at places, that's what I wanted to see, was someone who was willing to, you know, pull up his sleeves and dive into a coolant tank if needed be at any point in the day. And like, that's where I want to work, is somebody who's, you know, doesn't try to be better than me constantly.
Yeah, that's something that I've really had to work on in my mentorship styles, because it's very easy for me to just interact with these people how I think in my head. And if I said all the things to my friends that I was thinking in my head, I don't think terrible things, but they would sound terrible. They would sound very arrogant, and they would sound like I think I'm better than everybody else, when in reality, I don't think that. And when you approach these people, you just have to approach everybody differently. And it's really that simple.
Yeah, for sure. Any other big lessons learned while you've been mentoring? Anything else you want to share?
I'm sure there's a million things that I'll remember as soon as we stop recording. I think you have to forget the circumstances that you're in. I guess to give a little background, starting from the beginning, in 2019, when I joined the team, I was doing all manual stuff and a little bit of CNC. And that was the first year of F28, our car F28. And then COVID hit halfway through second semester, and that stopped everything immediately. And then came back the following year, and I was elected a CNC lead. And so I finished most of the CNC parts. And so for that car, I made most of the manual parts and most of the more complicated ones. And then the following fall, I was elected again because nobody expressed interest. And so now for F30, we skipped F29. Now for F30, I made most of the complicated parts. And then the following year, several people did express interest, but since F30 was another 2-year cycle, then there were no parts for them to make. And now this year, I was like, okay, now I'm really going to step back and I'm going to let other people do the work. And that was working. And then it appeared that manufacturing was going to be the bottleneck. And that's, of all the groups to be a bottleneck, everybody's most afraid about manufacturing. I don't know how it is in the real world, but everybody's like, I need my parts. And if you're the problem, but there's another problem, you're the real problem. And so everybody was very afraid of that happening. And so I was asked to step in by a team administration, and I did reluctantly, and I made a lot of parts. And now it turns out we're not the bottleneck at all, and there's other groups slowing us down. And so I have accidentally taken a lot of work from my disciples, and I am very regretful of that. And I feel very bad that I've robbed them of so much work, but I have to remember that it's not my fault, and I was just doing the best that I could given the circumstances. And that's just one, you know, fairly long-winded example, but you can't be too hard on yourself, which is something I am all the time.
Yeah, but no, I think that shines a light on a very common issue in manufacturing. I think that we're, even just in general, for like people like us who have all these projects going on the side, it really is, manufacturing is that stage that we feel on the other side where it's like, oh, well, I'll buy all the things for the project, and then of course I'll work on it, and then they sit on your shelf for a year or two. Yep. But because we're making the parts, we are on the opposite side of that. You know, they expect the Amazon one day turnaround, and it's like, things take time to be made, especially when they're tight tolerance or difficult. And yeah, I think that that's a tough place to be for sure.
Yeah. There's a lot of people, well, not anymore, but there were a lot of people on my team who used to come over to my desk and say, where are my parts? When am I getting them? And now we have fostered an environment on the team where, instead of wondering where the parts are, people wonder, how can I help? How can I make my parts simpler? What can I do to be a resource to you? And we totally have turned the tables. Instead of manufacturing, like trying to please everybody else by doing things quickly, I'm very happy to report that now the designers are trying to please us, because they know that we're the only thing standing between them and a finished car. And if your parts suck and you're not nice to us, we're not going to make your parts quickly.
How did you do that? How did you pull off that magic trick? Because I think that the initial response to where are my parts are is usually a pretty snarky one from any machinist. So how did you suppress that urge? And then what did you say, and how did you endear that?
There definitely were some snarky remarks. I definitely was not always super nice to people, and I'm glad that I've turned a new leaf. The way I did it, I think, was just being assertive and confident and telling people, I know you want your parts, but look around. Everybody else needs their parts. And until everybody has their parts, it doesn't matter if you have your part, because the car's not driving until the chassis built, aero's on it, suspension's on it, until there's a steering wheel. And if you don't have a steering wheel, but somebody else is making your suspension brackets. It doesn't matter when I get you your part because everybody needs their stuff and we're all in it together. There was a very toxic environment on the team maybe 10 or so years ago, which faded out almost entirely about 5. And so now we've got a whole new generation on the team. And I think that played a large part in creating that environment because nobody came in and immediately saw the environment of hostility. They came in and saw the environment of, you know, collaboration and positivity. And maybe we did better at competition in previous years, but that's because everybody was miserable spending 80 hours a week. Everyone hated each other because they were spending so much time together. And I would much rather place 4th out of 72 teams, putting in 40 hours a week and being happy with my friends, than place 1st and be absolutely miserable for 8 months a year.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, I mean, this is also your college experience. And so, yeah, like, the last thing you want to do is look back on college and go, man, I remember the worst days and I'm at work and it's somehow a breath of fresh air. Like, that sounds terrible.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I think we've gone through all of shop news and new things, unless there's anything else new or exciting in your world.
I think that's pretty much it. I've been touring a lot of shops, as many as I can. When I was at Moog near Buffalo, I toured Keller Technology Corporation, which I found from an Instagram ad. They've got some massive Mori machines, so that was cool. I went and hung out with Tucker a few times. I saw Peak Motion, toured Ledyard's shop, just kind of getting to know people. I've been putting a lot of emphasis on meeting people and going new places and not just being in my machining hole. But yeah,
that's awesome. That sounds like a lot of fun. I've always wanted to make some time and go out and visit some more shops.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Well, that brings me to the last two questions then I ask every guest every week. First of which, what did you research this week? Doesn't have to be machining related, though it might be, you know, what's been popping up in your browser.
Well, as we mentioned, full-time jobs. I'm looking for jobs. If anybody is hiring, let's chat. Of course, being a better mentor, I talk a lot, although not as much lately. I talk a lot with my former engineering teacher who I mentioned on the last episode, Mark. He's always a great source of insight, always has positive things to say. Researching new projects, researching hardware storage systems. We go through so many bolts on the team, and having a robust system that isn't just like kind of crappy plastic snappy boxes that fall apart after a year, that's very important. And so trying to find a company that makes those and can sponsor us is tricky.
Any headway there or anything you found that was pretty interesting? Because I think that a lot of us struggle with organization.
Yeah. Durham Manufacturing is a company that makes them, and I was in contact with them, but then the line kind of went cold. There were a few other ones that I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's hard. It's like surprisingly difficult in a modern world of manufacturing to find good, reliable, not insanely expensive organization equipment. Yeah.
Yeah. I can completely understand why so many people have turned towards Gridfinity, because it's like, well, at least it's modular and I can print it and, you know, there's no sourcing issues or anything like that. I know we have shallower bins at my shop and I'm not super unhappy with them, but I'm not super happy with them either. They're just kind of meh. So I'm always looking for something better.
Yeah. I made a little parametric shallower bin model in Fusion, and you just output the size you want and 3D print it just to fill the little cavities in all of our drawers for end mills and stuff like that. That's been helpful. Some other random stuff I've been researching. My friend Kate challenged me to machine a billet stainless steel cutlery set. So I've been thinking about that. That will be interesting.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. We have, from many years ago, a donation. We have this 6-inch diameter, maybe 12-foot long bar of 465 stainless from Carpenter. And we have absolutely no use for it other than once a year we make a 3-inch diameter part. And I sit at the lathe for like 4 hours swapping an insert every other pass because the stuff is so gummy. So I'm going to use some of that for this cutlery set. Yep.
Awesome.
How about you? What are you researching?
Well, I said on the last one, I have my GD&T test in like just over 2 weeks, something like that. So I have been putting in a few hours a night into that and reading the standard and trying not to fall asleep while doing all of it. It's actually like it's started to get more interesting as I get deeper into it, which is nice. You know, I've always been kind of a metrology nerd as it is. And so really knowing the right way to do stuff is great. But besides that, like a lot of it is just like new shop stuff and figuring out the layout and then, yeah, just studying for my test.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, the last question is, what are the things you're doing to be a better person, leader, employee, what have you? None of us are perfect. We're all working on stuff. What are you working on?
I'm working on a lot of things. People make jokes about how they like gain consciousness in third grade and realize they're a real person. I feel like I'm going through a second awakening, and I don't know when it started, but fairly recently, where I've started to realize all the unhealthy habits that I have. So obviously, I'm working on mentoring people better. I'm trying not to be in my head about everything because I'm like constantly thinking nonstop. It's like an audiobook in my head at like 4x speed and max volume. And so trying to slow down and just realize that the world around me is not thinking about me. And so I don't have to worry about that. I'm working on being more thankful for other people around me. I definitely do not show my thanks enough for friends and family. I'm working on how to relax and how to get exercise. I was a very active kid all my life up until college and then kind of went cold turkey because I just put all my time and effort into formula. And my friends, my family told me I should, you know, go find a squash court because I've been playing squash for many years and I could not find one in the nearby area. And then 2 weeks ago, my friend was like, you know, there's a squash court on campus. And I was like, well, actually, I didn't. And it would have been nice if you told me that 4 years ago. But now I know. So I've been playing every day. I'm playing with friends. That's been great. I forget who was on the podcast, but someone said something along the lines of, it's really unfortunate how good physical exercise makes you feel. And I really resonate with that.
I think it was Joe Barnard that said that. Yeah. And I completely agree. Yeah, that's also something I have on and off been really trying to tackle. Because yeah, I go through very busy spells at work where it's like, I don't want to work or I don't want to work out at the end of a 14, 15 hour day, or, you know, I'm like working all day and then quoting or something or programming at night. It's like the last thing I want to do is add one more thing and get that much less sleep. But I do, you know, feel that much better when I do it. So it's definitely a tough thing.
Yeah. Yeah, you wake up in the morning and you've got like crippling back pain on one side, which I'm way too young to be experiencing. And then I'll go play squash and I'll realize halfway through that I feel nothing anymore. And it's like, it's crazy how that works. Yeah. And relaxing. Relaxing is another thing that I'm working on, which I'm positive everybody listening to this podcast can relate to. I couldn't tell you the last time I just sat down and took a nap or just did nothing and just stared at the wall with my thoughts. That's just not something that I've ever had time to do in the last 5 years. And it's a very valuable thing.
It's really tough, though. It like really, really is tough.
Yeah.
I know. Try to find it. Easton sent me a meme yesterday or the day before that was something along those lines because it's just insanely hard to relax, especially when you have so much, you know, going on. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. Yeah. One more time, can we get the 7 key things of mentorship before we close? Because I want to hear those one more time.
Yeah, let me scroll to my... All right, so we got forget time. Mentoring is slow, extremely slow. Forget your standards and expectations. Everyone starts somewhere and expecting them to live up to what you've done is a one-way ticket to disappointment for all parties involved. Similarly, failure of the student must be treated as failure of the mentor. Forget first impressions. Patience is key. Almost all students have potential. It's your job to pull it out of them. Forget your age, skills, and talents. You are the servant now, and it is your job to be a servant leader. And a quote that my mentor Mark gave me. He said, cursed is the life of someone gifted with talent and forced to work among those who haven't developed it yet. It's your job to help others develop it. Forget your ego. It's about growing the student, not how much you've grown. To mentor is to cheer someone on from the sidelines as they finish the race, even if they do it faster than you did the first time. Forget what you think you know and see. You are having an impact, even if it doesn't show. People don't dislike you for knowing more, and if they do, then it's their problem. Forget those with no desire to learn. You can't help someone who doesn't want to be helped.
Awesome. I love those. And then one more time, please plug whatever you want, the car, where they can donate, all that stuff. And then where can they find you online?
So my Formula team on Instagram and I think Facebook and probably LinkedIn, we are RIT_racing. We're running crowdfunding now. We're trying to get to 15 grand and then we get some additional money from the university if we hit that. I am e.patain515 on Instagram. I guess if you want to find me on LinkedIn, you just search Ethan Patain. Other than that, that's pretty much it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming back on. I definitely learned a lot and have some more things to cement in my memory before we hire for sure. Thank you to all the listeners. Thanks to all the Patreon members, new Patreon member, Brad. Thank you so much. Let's me send people like Ethan a mic and headset so you guys get good audio. Thank you all for listening, and I will be back next week.